Today on the podcast, we talk all about PCOS, mold, and when IVF may not be needed with Dr. Natalie Underberg. PCOS is one of the leading contributors to female infertility, yet the conventional model doesn't do a very good job supporting women who are experiencing this complex syndrome. Dr. Natalie breaks it down and shares what she often recommends from a holistic perspective, the role mold may be playing in your fertility struggles, and why IVF might not be needed even if you've been told that's your only option. I loved interviewing Dr. Natalie, so let's dive in. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
But first, a moment from our sponsor, the best skin healing product that I've ever come across. Active Skin Repair is a skin health company that makes natural, non-toxic medical-grade sprays and gels to help support skin healing by using something called hypochlorous acid, which mimics the natural healing response that the body uses itself. Very intelligent and an absolute game changer for a huge variety of skin ailments, including burns, cuts, scrapes, bites, rashes, stings, eczema, acne, and more. I highly recommend carrying a bottle in both your bag and your car. I use it on my baby, my dog, and my acne-prone skin. It's such a smart product and we think you will love it. Head to activeskinrepair.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 20% off your order.
I have the privilege to interview Dr. Natalie Underberg today. She is the founder of the PCOS Doc brand, a distinguished functional medicine doctor, renowned speaker, and dedicated educator, specializing in women's health, fertility, and polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. With a background that includes a doctorate of chiropractic and advanced training from the Institute of Functional Medicine, Dr. Natalie is at the forefront of the women's health domain. Having faced her own battles with health challenges like PCOS, chronic respiratory issues, and chronic fatigue throughout her life, Dr. Natalie's journey inspired her to become a beacon of healing for others. Frustrated by the lack of definitive answers from numerous doctors, she embarked on a path of functional medicine, driven by the desire to truly understand and address the root causes of health struggles while providing a compassionate and attentive approach to patient care. Dr. Natalie, thank you so much for being here to chat with us all about PCOS and fertility. I'm so excited to interview you.
I know. I've been looking forward to this. I'm so glad we could do it.
I know. So you work a lot with fertility. You specialize a lot in PCOS, and PCOS, for those who don't know, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is one of the leading causes of female infertility. Can you just talk to us a little bit about PCOS, what it is, just for those who don't know or maybe aren't sure, maybe they have it and they're just not sure that that's what's going on? Can you speak to that?
Yes. So PCOS is kind of this very complex metabolic condition, and there's a constellation of symptoms that go along with it. So a lot of times PCOS can be misdiagnosed for other things or missed for other things or overdiagnosed. But a lot of the common symptoms that I see with PCOS are acne, weight gain, fatigue, dysglycemia or blood sugar issues in general, presence of cysts on the ovaries or follicles on the ovaries that don't belong or in excess, a lot of menstrual irregularities or anovulatory issues. But usually I find that a big driver of PCOS is inflammation that just doesn't make sense. When I'm seeing my patients, if they've come in without a diagnosis, it's usually these chronic inflammatory issues that have never really added up to any sort of a diagnosis for them. And then I figure out what's driving that inflammation. Is it this insulin issue? Is it dysglycemia? Is it a gut-related issue? And a lot of these issues mask their PCOS, which is why they're not getting diagnosed. But in general, it's a very complex, widespread metabolic condition that looks very different in most people. And I would say there's no one case of PCOS that's exactly the same, but that's why I think it's fun to work with those clients.
That's amazing. I think you think it's fun. I feel like the conventional world doesn't because people, you know, the conventional medical model wants things to fit into a perfect little box and to check all the marks to be a diagnosis. And if you don't fall into those perfect little boxes, they don't know what to do with you. So can you chat a little bit about what it takes to actually be diagnosed with PCOS? And then we'll kind of talk about some of the nuances.
Yes. Okay. I love this question because this gets missed so often and people get it wrong so often. I just saw a stat this morning and a very large percentage of medical professionals actually do not know the diagnostic criteria for PCOS, which is wild to me. I was like, how do you know
that? That is wild. It's not that hard.
Yes. And it's like 70% of OBGYNs don't understand how to diagnose it properly. So you have to qualify for two of the three diagnostic criteria for PCOS, which are the presence of hyperandrogenism or excess androgen, so DHEA, testosterone, DHT, things like that. And ovulatory cycles, so meaning you're not ovulating or you have missed cycles, elongated cycles, completely regular cycles over 35 days, and then a polycystic ovarian morphology, so the presence of cysts on the ovaries or follicles on the ovaries. You have to have two of the three of those. You can't just have one and get the diagnosis. A lot of women have excess androgens and they're being slapped with the diagnosis, but they still ovulate regularly every month and they still... they do not have the presence of cysts on the ovary. So you have to have two of the three. And also you can kind of look for elevated AMH. I kind of utilize that in my own brain as a diagnostic criteria. And then also elevated insulin. So those are just two extra. If you also have elevated insulin and you have elevated AMH, you can kind of start to make the connection that you might be falling into that PCOS pattern.
Yeah. And this is something that I feel like is important to bring up is there are a lot of women who don't meet the diagnostic criteria, but have what I call PCOS-like syndrome or PCOS-type pattern. And I'm actually one of those people because I have polycystic ovaries, but I do not have high androgens and I do not have irregular cycles. But I do have slightly elevated insulin and I have high AMH, which I have high AMH because I have polycystic ovaries. And so when I had to go through IVF, they sort of saw me and treated me like a PCOS patient, even though I didn't have quote unquote PCOS because of my polycystic ovaries. But this is where it gets really tricky because some women might have experiences where their doctor says, oh, you don't have PCOS, yet the underlying, you know, root causes and all of these things are actually very similar. Like blood sugar is a huge part of my life. I have to keep it very in balance, which is why this pregnancy has been very hard. So can you talk about that? Because I think a lot of people don't really understand dysglycemia or blood sugar things. Like, how do you know if there's a blood sugar thing? Is it always obvious? Do you have to test? Can you talk to us about blood sugar?
Yeah, of course. I think one of the biggest drivers, about 70% of cases of PCOS have what's called insulin resistance, which you know, right? And that's just where our cells become super resistant to insulin and getting glucose into the cells where they belong. And we just have this elevated blood glucose all the time, which for a lot of women that I'm seeing causes fatigue after meals, causes insane sugar cravings. I always say, because the glucose is not getting into the cell, your cells are just screaming at the brain for sugar all the time. Like they're just craving that sugar. They need energy and they're not getting it. So that incessant craving for sugar can be common. It can also just be having a sweet tooth. A lot of people just say like they have a sweet tooth, which can also be candida. That's another thing. But as we know, also the inability to lose weight or carrying weight in the midsection or certain areas of the body, like on the backs of the arms, that can be common with insulin resistance. So there's a couple things there. Brain fog, I see that a lot, especially if you get sleepy and brain foggy after meals or between meals, that can be really, really common. And then also just having a general craving for carb-heavy foods and higher glycemic foods versus a higher protein diet or a leaner diet. I find that women with insulin resistance just kind of lean toward those higher glycemic foods and the higher carbohydrate foods just innately, because that's what our body is craving, because that glucose is not getting where it belongs into the cell to give us energy. So those are kind of some of the main things that I see. But then the sneakier cases with just this ever so slightly higher levels of insulin, you don't always see all those. It could just be that you have to look for labs and run labs and see the higher indicators of higher insulin levels or a little bit slightly higher A1C or even high or low fasting glucose. Because I'm seeing a lot of reactive hypoglycemia where people are doing this like roller coaster throughout the day. And if you test their blood and you're just looking at glucose, it could be in the low 70s or even mid 70s. And they're still insulin resistant because they're on that roller coaster of reactive hypoglycemia.
Yeah, so, that's definitely me. I have reactive hypoglycemia. So for those who don't know, like my experience, the first time I ever understood blood sugar, I think I talk about this in my course, I was in college and, you know, I was trying to get into the world of nutrition and you just don't know. And even the traditional, you know, my undergrad was in food science and human nutrition. It's just a lot of the nutrition education is very confused itself in this country. But I remember going to the dorms and eating a huge bowl of yogurt, which at the time, I'm sure the yogurt had like 30 grams of sugar and some granola. And that was it, thinking I was eating healthy, you know, because the traditional dietitian recommendations were like, don't eat eggs and bacon, eat yogurt and granola, which is actually the opposite of what you should do. But, and I was walking to class and I passed out, literally mid walk. And I just didn't understand. And I knew I always felt weird and had like shaky things. But what happened was that surge of sugar was so intense for my system that it caused an actual crash, right? I was having a reaction to the food, a reactive hypo, low blood sugar situation. And your brain just kind of shuts down when you don't have sugar. And I realized after that point that I really needed to figure this out and understand. And since then, you know, I'm so careful with protein and I actually can't have – like if I ate a piece of fruit alone, you know, for a snack, it would just be really bad for me. So I have to be really careful. And so for anyone listening who might think, and I don't have an issue with weight. Sometimes women with PCOS don't, you know, they can have more lean body type, but you just might have more issues with blood sugar and food. And so I just want to highlight that because although I'm not technically a diagnosed PCOS person, I feel like I have to navigate the world similarly to someone with that imbalance. And so I just want to highlight that for people who might feel like they're not in the classic, you know, look or, you know, I've even had patients where doctors will be like, well, you're not overweight, so you don't have PCOS.
Like, I do that all the time. It's my most frustrating case that comes in because they will go from doctor to doctor to doctor. The average is three doctors over 2 years before someone gets an accurate diagnosis, which is crazy. But that is the most missed client I see. And those are more of like what I call like an adrenal pattern or a stress pattern PCOS picture, which it's not always because like we said, we can't put people into these boxes, right? Yeah. But absolutely, those are the women that are getting misdiagnosed the most is the leaner women who don't struggle with weight because they're brushed off. Mm-hmm. And then women who are overweight are immediately given a PCOS diagnosis. Yep. And they're stereotyped of, you're overweight, you must have PCOS. Yeah. Here's metformin, it'll solve all your problems.
Right.
What I also love to do is every year or two, I do like a 2 to 3 week, maybe even 4 week trial with a CGM, which is a continuous glucose monitor for you listening. That has been super insightful. Every time I have done it, the first time I did it, I did realize I was more reactive hypoglycemic and I've always battled weight issues. Like, very easy to gain weight if I do not like keep everything right on point. But I was running low with my blood sugar all the time. Like my glucose was in the low 70s after my workday if I didn't eat every 2 to 3 hours and things like that. So I was much more aware of how stress impacted my body, how certain foods impacted my body, and even healthy foods. People will like load up on sweet potatoes and rice and things like that. And they don't realize those are very high glycemic foods that can very likely send you on this blood sugar roller coaster. So I highly recommend if you suspect blood sugar issues and you can do it and you can get one, wearing a wearable CGM is super helpful and super insightful for figuring out, A, your food triggers, but also do you have really elevated blood glucose? Do you have really low blood glucose? I have a friend of mine who's super athletic, super fit, very high muscle mass, and her blood sugar is high all the time.
Oh, wow.
And she's very active. And so that doesn't make a ton of sense either if you were to put her in a box either way. So it's really interesting. That's why it's so bio-individual. And you really have to figure out how your body responds to things and how your cells are responding post-meal and things like that.
I love that. I feel like that tool is so helpful. I actually haven't done it myself. It's something I've been needing to, and I really should have done during this pregnancy, even though, because blood sugar stuff can play a role in nausea, you know, and I know that. And that's been a huge struggle because when you need to eat protein all of the time and then you're having food aversions, it just creates this whole new complication. But it took me a long time to figure out, you know, especially the classic breakfast of you know, Western worlds or even, you know, lots of places around the world, especially with the influence of America. I think we just ruin everything. But, you know, the classic oatmeal for breakfast or cereal for breakfast or pancakes for breakfast. I can't do that. And it took me a long time to figure that out because that was how we were raised, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we did have eggs and bacon and things like that at times, but I think so many people turn to carbs for breakfast and it can just start your whole day off. So can you talk to us, for someone who might suspect they have PCOS or a blood sugar issue, or they know they have PCOS, what do you recommend as tips for blood sugar management?
Yes. My number one piece of advice across the board is use movement as your best form of medicine when it comes to blood sugar management. So immediately after a meal, going for like a brisk 10 to 20 minute walk is going to be your very best friend. We always tell our patients to use movement as insulin, so your body doesn't have to work so hard to secrete insulin after a meal. So movement can be amazing. Obviously resistance training, higher muscle mass is also going to help with that in general, generally speaking. But then finding the right herbs for your body can be really helpful. So insulin sensitizing herbs like berberine can be helpful for the right person, right? I love NAC, which is N-acetylcysteine. I love that for, as an insulin sensitizer, and inositol, which is myo-inositol is one of the most widely studied nutrients for PCOS across the board. We have so much good literature supporting that for PCOS, which is amazing. And more just keeps coming out, but it's so safe. Most women respond so well to it. It's very gentle. And it also has added benefits. It helps with excess androgens. It helps with keeping testosterone under control, but also supporting ovarian health in general, which I love. So a lot of these herbs and nutrients have multiple benefits. So with PCOS, when you have that constellation of symptoms, finding an herb that can help with three of them, you're killing three birds with one stone, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But I would say a combination of movement and then also dietary wise, always having a protein forward meal. So like you mentioned, not starting your day with a carb source like protein or like a oatmeal or pancakes, which will totally send you on a blood sugar roller coaster if you are insulin resistant. Eggs and bacon, like you already mentioned, something that's very protein heavy to start your day. I always suggest having the bulk of your calories in the form of protein in the first half of the day as much as you can.
Yeah.
Loading up on breakfast, having a bigger lunch, and kind of tapering down from there. And then getting small walks and small bite-sized pieces of movement all throughout the day can be really helpful. So a lot of people will go to the gym one time during the day and then they don't move for the rest of the day. And those people are some of my most insulin resistant people. So they're like, I'm killing it at the gym. I'm working hard. And they go home and they sit on their computer all day long with no bite-sized pieces of movement throughout the day.
Yeah.
Or bits of movement. So that's really helpful. So protein forward meals, making sure you're getting enough fiber in with meals. Fiber is amazing for helping with blood sugar stabilization, and then avoiding those high glycemic foods. So figuring out what that is for you and how your body responds is very helpful, but the white breads, the rice, the sweet potatoes, things like that can be higher glycemic and they can kind of send you on that roller coaster. A little trick, and you've probably done this before, is if you're going to have potatoes, make them a resistant starch and cook them. Cool them overnight and eat them the next day.
Yeah.
That is basically the only way I can eat potatoes without having to have like some, you know, severely high glucose spike. But it's a really amazing trick to help with that blood sugar mitigation a little bit so you don't have such a high glucose spike after a meal.
I love that. And for anyone listening who doesn't know, I'm big on teaching and analogies. And I know some of you probably know this, but if you don't, the way I think of insulin is it's like the key that unlocks the door in the cell to let glucose in or food. So you can think of it like the boy who cried wolf. So in insulin resistance, imagine insulin is knocking at the door saying your food delivery is here, glucose is here, cell take open the food. And when you have insulin resistance, it's like someone's knocking on the door all the time. And so the cell's just like, I'm not paying attention to you. You're here all the time. Yeah. I'm not going to answer you anymore. It becomes resistant to the insulin. So when you're talking about exercise and these herbs that make you more insulin sensitive, that would be like, you know, making the knock on the door a doorbell, or maybe pausing the insulin to be there all the time so that when the knock happens, it has more meaning and the cell opens that door to allow glucose in. So that's what we're talking about when we say sensitive to insulin or insensitive to insulin, because I think some people don't realize that that's the role of insulin and it can feel abstract to people. And so I think in analogies, so I like imagine these little insulin knocking on the door being like, open up and let the food in. So that's super helpful.
if you don't address insulin at the root too, insulin perpetuates elevated testosterone. It affects our ability to ovulate. It affects the ovaries. The ovaries are so sensitive to insulin in general, or oxidative stress, which insulin perpetuates inflammation. It's like this whole inflammatory cascade. It's a snowball. Like if you don't find the root of whatever your PCOS driver is, you don't address that and you try to mask it, that is where we run into problems, because you're just having this inflammatory cascade that's just running and running and running, and it gets out of control. So you have to find out what your drivers are. I mean, that's so important, I feel like.
And what would you say are the most common drivers when you look at patients and clients? I know it can be different for every person.
About 70% of them, it's insulin resistance. So addressing blood sugar is key for that. Trauma is another really big one. A lot of PCOS clients, they've done studies showing that there's a correlation between childhood trauma and PCOS patterns, more so there's like adrenal stress patterns.
Yeah.
So trauma is a really big one. Inflammation in general, figuring out what specifically is causing that. Is it the blood sugar or is it underlying gut infections? Is it trauma causing the inflammation? Is it environmental? Is it toxin exposure? Things like that. Gut infections, like I mentioned, H. pylori we see in so many of our PCOS clients. It's not even funny. Yeah. And then just dysbiosis in general, SIBO, IBS is super common with IBS, I should say, air quotes.
I know.
Super common with our PCOS clients, which we know IBS just means there's something else going on in the gut that we have to figure out.
It doesn't have a diagnosis.
Yeah, it's not a diagnosis. It's not a diagnosis. But they come in and they're saying, I have IBS and PCOS. Yep. So we figure out why they have both of those and what it really means.
Yeah.
Toxins and fragrances from the environment. So those xenoestrogens. So fragrances in your perfumes, your body wash, air purifier, you name it. Like wherever fragrances are coming from, if they're synthetic, they can cause severe endocrine disruption in your body, which perpetuates PCOS symptoms. So we have to nail those down, remove them. I always tell my patients, one of the easiest things you can do is remove things from your environment. Instead of adding new things in, you can actually just remove the toxins and remove the triggers. And then you start to get better just with that. And then stressors that affect the androgen production. So my CrossFitters, my extreme athletes, things like that, they fit into these adrenal stress patterns that are the more lean PCOS cases. So sometimes we have to modify their movement. We have to cut back on their CrossFit a little bit. We have to lower the intensity of their workouts, because a lot of that will perpetuate these high cortisol states, which that's our main stress hormone, right? And that can also perpetuate adrenal stress issues and patterns, which exacerbate the acne with PCOS. They can exacerbate weight issues, fatigue, you name it. So that's another big one. And then obviously there's a really big genetic component to PCOS. So genetics, obviously, if you have a woman in your family that has PCOS, you are more likely to have PCOS. But the metabolic piece of PCOS, which we know it's largely a metabolic condition, we can actually inherit those from our family members. So that pancreatic beta cell dysfunction can actually be passed down from family members, both male and female, which is wild. So if you have a parent with type 2 diabetes or metabolic issues, insulin resistance, you name it, you're more likely to not only develop that, but also PCOS. Yeah. So the genetic piece is really, really interesting to me. And obviously we know we can change the way our genes express themselves through diet and lifestyle. So that's the most empowering piece is, yes, your parents may have this, but it does not mean that you are guaranteed to have this outcome. We can change. We can rewrite the story of your genes, which I think is really empowering. So I think they're not our destiny, as Ben Lynch likes to say.
Yes, I love that. I love the role of epigenetics. And I'm sure you've seen this study or the studies on this, and I'd be curious to know your thoughts. But I do a lot of work with male fertility, and it's pretty clear now that we know that phthalate exposure in utero, like for example, I'm pregnant with a boy. And if I were exposed to a lot of phthalates through fragrance, perfume, scented products, all of those, it has known to impact their testosterone and their reproductive development, lowering their testosterone. But through my research looking into it, I found that they are also finding some potential epigenetic influence on women. So baby girls in utero and their exposure to chemicals and toxins potentially impacting PCOS. Because you know, there's so many factors to be like, why is this huge explosion of PCOS all of a sudden happening in our generation in particular, when it maybe wasn't as common? You know, people just didn't struggle getting pregnant as much back in the day. There were always exceptions and like rare situations, but not like it is now. And it's like, we just look, the two things that have changed the most in the last two generations are food and toxins.
You know, like, our environment and our food is way more toxic than it was 20 years ago.
It's crazy. So, you know, but like you said, we can change so much of that. But when people kind of are like, why? Or I don't have a family history of this. Yes. Why me? Why do I have this? And, you know, for some people like me, it helps to kind of know origins of like where things come from and how I can change my life to maybe prevent that for my babies, you know, my kiddos. So just, I think the toxin piece is huge for men and women. And the other thing I wanted to say to your point, I don't remember, but I think that the epigenetic influence is super powerful, and PCOS more than anything, we can see the impact of changing our lifestyle and changing our exposures and how wonderful it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and then to touch on kind of another piece of that, because even in utero, your mother's stress and cortisol levels can actually impact your testosterone levels later on down the road. So like you're mentioning exposures in utero, this is also why I preach to my clients, and I know you do too, the importance of preparing your body in advance and getting your body into a safe place. It comes down to two, if everyone had their nervous system supported and under control going into pregnancy, like how much different health outcomes could be. Yeah. So looking back, maybe even 20, 25 years ago, before now we're seeing this huge resurgence of PCOS, which is crazy. But if mothers had more awareness around nervous system support, like we currently do now, more and more people are talking about the nervous system. It's like a trendy thing. I'm like, well, it's been around forever. Yeah. But the nervous system and cortisol is trending right now, but it really is so important for women. If you are in your preconception phase, like, do not overlook the power of balancing the nervous system and getting your stress under control and getting your nervous system into a safe place. Because I do also think women are living in this state of fight or flight all the time, which is exacerbating adrenal hormones and androgens, and it's elevating cortisol, which is contributing to belly fat and fatigue and all these other issues that go along with PCOS. So if you are dealing with high stress and you're in a high stress job or high stress environment, you have a dysregulated nervous system and PCOS, that's going to be a perfect storm for just complete havoc of your hormones, which it's all fixable. I always say this, it's always fixable. You have to at least be aware and conscious of the problem so that you can fix it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I know. I feel like sometimes the biggest prescription I have to tell my patients is a jobectomy, which I know is really hard. I get it, like the economy and the state that it is. But, you know, sometimes there's different things that you can shift to. For example, you know, I have nursing patients who work night shifts and have these crazy hours. And I just don't understand why we do this to our medical people. I'm just like, what? This is so terrible for you and your hormones. But, you know, like I've had patients, especially through the COVID shenanigans and everything, you know, shift to stable 9 to 5, you know, inpatient or outpatient jobs, and they're not in crazy surgery or ER situations. And I know that's not an option for everybody, but just seeing, can I change something? Can I do something different? Can we move to another state so that our expenses are half of what they used to be, so I don't have to work as hard? You know, like there's just so many things that you can do, because I think people sometimes feel trapped, but there's so much that you can do to support your stress, support your nervous system, even something as simple as just sitting on the grass and grounding every day, which is free and easy and you can do on your lunch break or anytime. Like there's so much that you can do to support it.
Yes. I always tell people, just get out of your normal environment for like 10 to 20 minutes a day, which it sounds like it's not a lot, but I have a lot of people who work in medical offices or are nurses or whatever. I'm like, on your lunch break, get out of the building, get out of the fluorescent lights, go for a walk, find a grassy area that you can just sit down in or walk in. Because that little like break from your norm can help the nervous system more than we even know. And so I love that point that you just made, because it's so valid. Yeah.
Or having moments of stillness. I think that this is something people don't take for granted, and they think that there has to be such a big thing, which sometimes there does. But sometimes, you know, we're so when the thing that happens is that we create these trauma patterns, and when your nervous system is always sort of on, it has a really hard time turning off, and we seek more stimulation subconsciously and we don't even realize it. So for example, if you have 10-minute break, people pull out their phone and they scroll, or they learn, or they research, or listen to something. And it's like, I just encourage people to do this. And it's so hard. It's so hard for people, especially go, go, go people, to just have nothing, silence for 10 minutes. It's like the hardest thing for people to do, but our nervous system needs a break. It doesn't need to always be consuming and scrolling and learning and researching. And I think women even come up with this. I know we've talked about reading, and reading isn't like a huge thing that you do passion-wise for fun, but the women who I know who are big self-development readers who start to read fiction, they're like, it blows their whole mind, because they're like, I'm just doing this thing that I'm not constantly learning. I'm not constantly going, but even reading like a fiction book is still stimulating your nervous system. But it's just to show how much we as a culture don't ever pause or break, and how that's so powerful.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. Yeah.
I love it.
It's the one piece of work that people usually are most resistant to, I've noticed too, is the emotional work and the nervous system work. Like my most resistant fertility cases, I would say, are those that they do not want to address or acknowledge the nervous system piece, which is the last part.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Did you know that stress impacts egg quality? Stress increases oxidative damage that negatively impacts your eggs. This is why it's important to really support your eggs no matter where you are along your fertility journey. I personally love Needed's egg support product. I helped design this formula, so I obviously love it, but even if I hadn't, it would be the one I would recommend to my patients and clients. This formula is an antioxidant and mitochondrial powerhouse that supports the oxidative damage that many things, including stress, can cause. It has key ingredients like L-carnitine, green tea extract, PQQ, and ALA. I love pairing it with Needed's prenatal to get your essential nutrients, as well as their CoQ10 product. Visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER. Okay, back to the show. So talk to us about IVF, because a lot of women who are diagnosed with PCOS or are struggling with fertility, in our conventional model, after a year of trying, they're kind of just given the option of IUI or IVF depending on their situation. And us being functional medicine practitioners have a very different approach, but a lot of people don't know that that exists. Can you kind of talk to us about what you see in practice and how women might not need to go down that route, especially not right away?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always say anytime anyone comes to me, first of all, we need to rule out, and you're the expert on this, but we need to rule out male factor right away, because it's 50-50. It's just as important that we rule it out. But also, I find that couples are being sent down the IVF route prematurely because there's not a great understanding of how to manage PCOS in the conventional model from a holistic perspective, right? So understandably, I always tell people, your medical doctor is not trained in this, and that's okay. The same way I am not trained in surgery, right? So they don't know how to guide you on this, and it's not their fault. But what I am finding is that if you put in 3 to 6 months of hard work on the lifestyle changes, the IVF route is almost always avoidable in about 90% of cases.
Yeah.
The other 10% falls into structural issues, genetic issues, male factor issues, which those are always things I tell people, there's only so much I can do for you. And that is where modern medicine comes in and is amazing. Mm-hmm. But what frustrates me is the other 90% of women who are thrown down this IVF route, and a lot of them bankrupted over it, essentially. Yep. Those are the ones that break my heart, because I'm like, a lot of this is really avoidable if we really master blood sugar, we get you on the right supplement protocol, we run the right hormones and test the right hormones for you, we look at precursor hormones and figure out why the body is not functioning the way it is. We got to figure out those drivers. We got to get to the root of it. We have to support the nervous system. We have to support lifestyle changes. We might have to do a jawbectomy, like you said, which is very true. We have all these women in this fast-paced world working 30 days a month like men, which is just not realistic. So I think that's a big thing, is that these lifestyle factors are not being addressed. And so that's why IVF success rates are also very, very low.
Yeah.
Because if we're not addressing that going into it, we can pump you full as full of as many medications as possible and put you through as many IUIs and transfers as possible. But if the environment and the host has not changed, the treatment is not going to matter, in my opinion. And that's what I've seen over and over, is like, we have to improve the host. We have to improve the system and the ecosystem in which that baby is going to be put into. Otherwise, outcomes are not going to change. So I hope that I don't know if that answered your question. Feel free to elaborate.
That was perfect. I think it was perfect. And I'm in such a unique situation as people who followed me, because I never wanted to do IVF. And this is the thing, is knowing what I know now, we should have probably pursued that so long ago. However, we were working on my own husband's host, you know, health, and trying to figure out why. And he had so many factors. It was almost misleading, because he had so many factors in his fertility case that, you know, we went down all of those routes. And I'm glad we did, because I understand them so much more. But it is very clear to me after going through it, and I've been in support groups with other people going through IVF, and I can very clearly kind of pinpoint and tell usually someone who really truly needs IVF and someone who really could have been helped through a holistic perspective. And that is really sad to me, because I know for some people they might look at IVF and be like, oh, this is just this quick, easy way for me to get pregnant.
Yes.
And that is not the case for a lot of people, especially like you mentioned, if the sperm is unhealthy and the female is unhealthy in any way, we can't force fertility. Correct. And this is, we talk so much on this podcast about the broken system at large, of just everything, because everything feels like it's broken. But there are so many people and practitioners and parts and pieces that are working. It's just they're not the mainstream common thing.
Yes.
But traditionally, at least in the last few decades, the conventional model has kind of seen the human body like a machine.
Yeah.
And they see our heart as a pump, and they see our kidneys as these filters, and we can replace them, and, you know, we control them. And there's this sort of egotistical mentality that's been created in certain circles that we know better, that we can get medications and pharmaceuticals to fix XYZ and do all these things. And no doubt there are amazing medical advancements that have saved lives and done all sorts of things. But I think why our fertility situation is so dire right now is that fertility is not a machine.
Yep.
And it is not something that you can force its hand.
Yes.
And there has to be a healthy host, like you said. There has to be a receptivity. There's so many factors that impact both male and female that don't have anything to do with pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
And our conventional model doesn't have an understanding or a reverence or a respect for that, unfortunately, in so many ways. And so I think that this is why so many couples are left unhelped and struggling. And when they're shuttled into the IVF model, if those things aren't addressed, you're in no better place to have a baby, yet you've just spent thousands and thousands of dollars in heartache and struggle, and you've pumped your body full of more hormones. And, you know, I'm a pro IVF for people who need it. I've been through it. I wouldn't have my children without it. And it is a completely inappropriate treatment for so many people, especially without the holistic support like you're talking about. And so I wish we understood that more as a culture and as a medical institution, because fertility is just, it's just not mechanical.
Yeah. I mean, I love that you're speaking to this too, because I have quite a few clients that are like, well, you know, this isn't quite working the way I want it to. I'm just going to go ahead and start taking XYZ, letrozole, Clomid, whatever medication, and maybe we'll just try an IUI. And I'm like, well, your baseline hormones still are not great. So you can try an IUI, but you're still putting an embryo or a baby or sperm or whatever it may be into an environment that is not yet prepared for that. Like, your estrogen isn't vibrant enough. Your progesterone is still not being produced at a healthy enough pace. You know, your inflammatory markers are still really high. So yes, the method of transport might be different to get that baby to you, but is it going to be successful? And that's what I always tell people. The success rates are so low for that reason.
Yeah.
And fertility specialists have told me this. They're like, The numbers are manipulated and skewed to get couples to pursue more and more and more rounds of these procedures. And they don't even feel like the system is ethical, because it's like couples go in with this false sense of hope that, well, I haven't gotten pregnant naturally, so this is obviously going to work, right? It's like they're bypassing the natural, the body's natural processes, which you can't do, which you just mentioned. Yeah. You know what I mean? So the host has to be addressed. And I always tell people, if you are going to a specialist and they've not asked you how you're eating, how you're sleeping, how are your emotions, how is your marriage, how is your thyroid, do you have any underlying trauma that still needs to be addressed? Do you have gut infections that still need to be addressed? If they're not asking you all of those questions and you have not been able to get pregnant, they are missing some glaringly obvious issues that really need to be talked about.
Yeah.
A lot of times it is severe stress from marital trauma, from marital problems, and these couples are just going through it at home. And that's never talked about. And I actually bring that up with my couples as like, how are you? Like from like a very foundational perspective, how are your stress levels? How do you feel about your finances? How do you feel about your lifestyle? And I have that on my intake forms. I look at like where their levels of stress are coming from.
Yeah.
Because if your finances are 9 out of 10 stress, is this really what you need to be focused on right now?
Yeah.
Or like, should you take a step back and address finances for 6 months and then start to try to get pregnant? Because if you're stressed 90% of the time about money, that's going to be a really hard transition into parenthood. So
yeah,
I look at things like really holistically when it comes to that from every angle. And so I find that if your doctor is not talking to you about that stuff, if your doctor is not bringing that stuff up, it's really a fundamental issue in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. That's so great. And that's what holistic medicine is, right? Because we are more, even diet and lifestyle, let's say how much we exercise, sleep, and eat. Those are pivotal foundational things, but there's more to us than that. You know, there is the childhood wounds and the past trauma and the interrelational dynamics and how we feel and experience the world and our level of safety. And, you know, there's just so many things that impact us. And unfortunately, this is why, you know, 8, 15, even 30-minute appointments sometimes just aren't enough. And, you know, the whole system is broken. It's not like it's the doctor's fault as to why we can't get into this stuff. We can get to like the fundamental level of all of that. But I think even if you are going to choose to go down IVF, whether it's because you have to or because you're giving yourself a year, you know, on the holistic route, and if it doesn't work, you're going to pursue it. The work, I always tell people, there should be no regret ever for improving anything about your and your partner's health, lifestyle, and environment.
Yeah.
It will only help in every way, whether you conceive naturally or whether you go through IVF. And I just wish everyone had that before they went through any sort of fertility trying. I mean, this is, you know, you and I could scream at the top of our lungs about preconception and how we just wish. It's just so hard. People don't think to fix a problem until there is a problem. And it's like, how do you get people to take this seriously and really work on optimizing things before they've been trying for a year, before they're so desperate that they don't want to take time to optimize? But even if you're someone listening who's decided to go through IVF, you know, just taking even a few months to optimize you and your partner can greatly change outcomes.
Yeah, 100%. And you mentioned the environmental piece, and I feel like we missed a really big topic, which is mold exposure.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about it.
I like clicked with me. I'm like, we talked about environmental, but like one of the biggest issues with fertility is mold in your environment causing neuroinflammation. So mold affects the brain. It's a neurotoxin. We know that, right? What I am seeing with a lot of patients is they're not ovulating. And I always go back to pituitary hormones. What are pituitary hormones doing? LH, FSH. And are those suppressed? Are those not functioning well? Is there neuroinflammation present? And if it is, please do not neglect to rule out mold.
Yes.
Because that is present in a lot of cases with low sperm count, low motility, low morphology that we're seeing with men. And then women who are having anovulatory cycles or really long cycles, or they're gaining weight really rapidly, which is causing inflammation, kind of almost mirroring a PCOS pattern potentially. Yep. like, I know you and I have both experienced crazy stories with mold, but that is one thing I'm like, I always feel bad if I don't mention it on a podcast. I'm like, yes. I'm doing the public a disservice by not bringing mold up. So feel free, like, talk about your experience with it too.
Yes. Let's please talk about mold, because I have been meaning to have one of my colleagues on to talk about mold, and yes. It just hasn't happened yet. And so we really haven't even addressed mold in the way that I would like to. So let's chat about it. Let's break it down for people, because I think some people are like, oh, my blueberries are moldy. Does that mean I have a mold problem? What are you talking about when you mean mold? Like, where is it coming from? How do you know that it's there? Because this can be a really challenging topic, because it's kind of hidden sometimes.
Yes. There's so many strains of mold. The ones I'm talking about are black mold, stachybotrys, mold that is found from water damage in the home. There's, I mean, so many different strains. Ochratoxin, there's Aspergillus, you name it.
Yeah.
But a lot of times homes, even new builds, I want to emphasize this. If you live in a brand new home, your home is not immune to mold. All you need is one storm or one little bit of rain while the home is under construction or being framed before they put up drywall, and your home could be built with mold in it. Mm-hmm. But what I'm finding is water damaged homes, homes that have basements or homes that have been flooded or have any sort of water damage. This could be a fridge leak. We have an infertility couple that we're working with right now. They literally had a leak in their refrigerator, went down their wall into their basement. They have mold everywhere. Mm. So little stuff like that, it can lead to issues like brain fog, fatigue, weight gain that mirror other issues, and it's oftentimes missed. But mold can be a systemic problem, not only in your home, but in your body. Yeah. So if you're experiencing symptoms out of the norm, maybe your seasonal allergies are worse than they were before. Maybe your brain just isn't working. Maybe your memory is worse than it was before. For my husband, he started to develop a tremor. For me, it was like blurred speech and really poor memory problems and rapid weight gain out of nowhere when we lived in a moldy home. So these are problems that it can affect your body systemically, but having this problem going into pregnancy is an even bigger issue, or attempting to get pregnant with this problem. But when in doubt, mold in the home can be a major issue. Mold in the workplace can be a major issue. I always tell people, look at the ceiling. Whenever you go into a building, look for water stains. Mm-hmm. Next time you go into like Target or TJ Maxx or whatever, this is a fun game. Like every time I go into a big store like that, there are water stains all over. Those buildings are notorious for having mold, but commercial buildings, because they're not maintained very well, oftentimes, those are big exposures for mold. Planes have mold. Cars can have mold. It really is everywhere. So I don't want to like create fear around it, but more so awareness.
Yeah.
So feel free, add in.
Yeah. No, I think it's super important. And I think people can feel really overwhelmed, because it's like, what? It's everywhere. What do I do? What I recommend with my patients, which I don't know about you, is if we suspect mold, I typically always recommend testing themselves.
Yes.
And testing for mold mycotoxins. Yes. So this is one thing that's confusing too, is if you go to your conventional doctor and say, I want to test for mold, typically they're going to be testing for like an allergy to mold. They might do like a skin prick test to see if you're allergic to mold. Yep. Some people are allergic to mold, but that is different than what we're talking about with mycotoxins, because there are hundreds, probably thousands of strains of mold, but there are just a select few that are toxic, and they release what are called mycotoxins. And these are non-living things. They are toxins like aluminum or, you know, phthalates are toxins. And you can test them in your body, and different toxins correlate to different species. So for example, if you do it's usually a urine test. If you do a mold test on yourself or your partner, you can just start with one if you're tight on finances, just to see, because if you're living in a home, both of you probably will have it. Yep. But at least start with one of you and see. And if your levels are very high, then you start, you know, investigating, okay, where could there be something in the home? Because I've had this experience where, like, I had a patient, and the reason we discovered mold was she was having a lot of weird symptoms that we were doing all the things, and she just wasn't getting better, and she was wanting to prepare for a baby.
Yep.
And it just didn't add up, right? When you as a person are like, I am doing the quote unquote things that they say, I'm eating well and I'm exercising, yes. I'm sleeping, I'm not stressed, but I feel so bad, or mm-hmm. I feel like I'm always kind of sick, or I'm always kind of struggling with things and I just don't feel right. Like, you are intuitive and you know way more than a doctor just says, oh, it's all in your head, nothing's wrong. Yeah. So any of these cases where something just doesn't feel right, there's bizarre symptoms. So for her, she would always feel better when she would leave on vacation. Yes. And her doctor was like, well, you're just stressed and vacation's helping you feel better. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
But like, I just knew that couldn't be it. I just knew her. I knew like her ways of being. Yeah. And I would say, you know, walk me through your whole day. Like, when do you feel the worst? And then, you know, she'd say, well, I really just feel the worst when I wake up. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, that's not normal.
Yeah.
And so it really started making me think, okay, is there something in your home that you're being exposed to that you feel worse yeah. at home? You feel worse when you've been there for 8 hours sleeping.
Yep.
And we had someone come out to investigate her house to check for mold.
Yeah.
So we tested her. She had mold mycotoxins. So I said, you're being exposed to mold somewhere. They had someone check her house. And the first pass, they're like, there's no mold here. We can't find anything. And she called me in tears and she's just like, I don't understand. Like, there's no mold. Yeah. I just don't know who to trust. And, you know, this is where we're like detectives.
Yep.
It's like, okay, yep. Well, somebody's wrong. Either the test is wrong, your symptoms are wrong, or the inspection people are wrong.
Or they didn't take the right kind of sample.
Right. It's like something's not adding up. And I was like, hire another company. Something's going on. Sure yeah. enough, the first company completely missed a closet in her room. When they went back there, it was black, covered in mold. All the coats, all the shoes. And I'm just like, how does a company miss that? But I see it yeah. all the time.
Me
so
too.
Some people will be like, I'm not going to test myself. I'm just going to test my house. But unfortunately, yes. sometimes those come back negative. When you test yourself and you know that there's mold, yep. you're so much more determined to figure it out. Or maybe you test both partners and only one yeah. has it. Okay, where do they go to work?
Yes.
Where are they spending most of their time? So it's like detective work, but
yeah.
you've got to find the source of the mold and fix it properly and then get that mold out of your body.
And it's not always visible. It's
yes.
not in the home. So most of the time it's not visible because these mycotoxins can travel through drywall.
Yep.
They can travel through walls. So you can have black mold behind a perfectly normal wall. Especially look for water sources like behind bathroom walls, behind showers, in if you have a second story, under like a bathroom on the yep. first floor, you might have water damage under that bathroom. But most of the time it is not visible. Once it's visible, you have a major problem. I always
yep.
tell people that. If it is visible to the naked eye, you have a major, major issue. And from cases we've seen a lot of times there's one person in the home that is more
yes.
symptomatic than the rest.
Yep.
And so 90% of the time it's the female and she will tell her husband, you know, I'm not feeling well. I suspect mold or whatever it may be. And the husband's like, well, I feel fine. The kids
yep.
feel fine.
Yep.
So it's probably not this because we all feel good. We had a client like this and her husband was like a neurosurgeon and he's like, I'm great. He was working out of the home like 18 hours a day.
Right.
So of course she's a stay-at-home wife. Of course she's going to feel worse. She's getting more of the exposure.
Yeah.
Also, if you work from home and you live out of your home mm-hmm. and you're the primary person in your household that's at home and you're the sickest one, it's very likely good indication that mold exposure is coming from your house.
Yeah.
But it's not just hiring any inspector. It's hiring
right.
the right one. Like you mentioned, you might have to bring in a couple companies, ask around.
Yeah.
And I always say hire a company or an inspector that's independent of a remediation company.
Yes.
That's very, very important.
And I see this. So I used to work in California and mm-hmm. we've talked about this because you're from the Florida and the Midwest
yeah.
areas. And I was like, California has the worst mold ever because they're all rentals that people don't
yes.
take tape up. You know, it's humid. There's a lot of poor quality construction from the 70s. And I mean,
yes.
I've had patients who had like 7 layers of linoleum on their floor that their landlord
yes.
would just like layer over when they had flooding. And I'm just like,
yes.
oh my gosh. So if you live in a rental, being aware of that. But I just yes. want to share the story of our house. We live in a brand new house in Idaho.
Yep.
And like, this is why it's important to just pay attention to these little things. The other day, I mean, this is probably like a month ago, I just noticed some discoloration on our baseboard. It just looked more gray. And I was like,
oh,
something, I don't remember that being there. I'm a pretty like detail-oriented person. I was like, huh. And, you know, I'm very aware of mold. My sister almost died from mold exposure. I mean, it's a huge problem. And I was pregnant. So I'm like, this is a big deal. And so I told my husband, and thank goodness I have a husband. And I, for those of you who have a partner who doesn't take you seriously, there are resources, you know, you can reach out to us, or I can put some in the show notes to help people understand the seriousness of mold, because a lot of people just don't understand it. But I told my husband, like, we need to investigate this, because I would have noticed this. And he's like, okay, well, that's super weird. But we do know that the pipes from our bathroom upstairs run along that wall.
Okay.
So we had a mold person come out, look in our crawl space. She's like, everything looks fine, but I can see that, like, the floor here is kind of squishy. Like, something's up. Like, I don't know. So we decided to cut a hole in the wall. And it turns out that my husband hung a mirror when we moved in. And right behind the wall, they put the pipe, a plastic pipe, for the piping for our upstairs bathroom. So he himself drilled into the plastic pipe. We didn't know.
It happens a lot.
We didn't know it was right behind the wall, in the center of the wall.
Yes.
And so since we hung that mirror, there was a slow drip of water from it wasn't even water. It was like sewage, gross, from our toilet, that was drip, drip, dripping, tiny drips into behind the wall. You couldn't see it at all except for this tiny discoloration. When we took it off, you know, there was starting to be mold growing. There was, and I was just like, this was what, 3 months? We hadn't even been in the house. Imagine 10 years.
Thank God that. You found it.
I know. Thank goodness.
But Kathy Cook come out?
Yes. Oh, she's no, not Kathy. Was she Kathy? Yes, I think it was Kathy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. She's coming to my house in like 2 hours.
That's so funny. But I, you know, this is just something for people to understand. Unless, you know, and you can get moisture readers and all sorts of things. There's a way to check it, but it wasn't super obvious, and that could have gone on for years. And so it's not always so obvious to people. So yeah, I just want to highlight that with mold, and it is a big player in fertility, especially with men.
Yes.
With morphology issues, you know, morphology is so tricky. And I see this so many times when they're quote unquote doing all the things perfect and there's still an issue. It's like there's something else that is impacting the oxidative damage in the body, and mold can definitely be a big one of those.
Yeah. Our reproductive organs in general are so sensitive to oxidative stress and oxidative damage. So yeah, that's, oh my gosh, such a valid point with all, I cannot even believe you guys are dealing with that. That's wild.
Well, we fixed it, thank goodness, but it, you know, costs a lot of money to do it right.
Wild. When we bought our house in December and we did our home tour with the builder, they specifically told us there's piping on these walls. Do not hang pictures here.
That's great. That's what should be done.
Yes. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even think of that. But they were like, this is where your bathroom pipes are running. Do not hang something on this wall. And I was like, thank you for telling me, because I probably would have. And it backs up to a wall on the master. And so I was just like, wow. So ever since then, I've been thinking about that, is how many people probably drill into their walls not knowing there's a pipe there.
Yeah.
It's wild.
The guy said tons, especially since they've moved to plastic pipes. You know, obviously if there was copper or metal back in the day, you would like hit it, but now it just drills right through. So yeah, just be aware of that, and just know that it's just another thing. Unfortunately, it's depressing. I get it, but don't let it depress you. But just know that we as human beings in this world, in this modern age, have to learn how to navigate the world differently than we used to, right? Our ancestors had to learn what berries were poisonous and how to, you know, keep away from the tigers and the bears and how to survive, you know, winters. And, you know, now we have to learn how to walk into a grocery store and not buy toxic food and how to like look at a home and understand if it's have water damage and, you know, how to place our environment, how to have EMFs that are safe. Like, it's not super challenging once you know, but it can feel overwhelming when it's all presented to you at one time.
Yeah.
It's just a knowing and a knowledge of how to navigate the world and have health. And unfortunately, if everyone just knew this information from the beginning, we would all just be in a much better place. But
this is
another
reason too, to have a functional medicine provider on your team, because they are going to help be that detective for you to figure out, is mold even something we need to be discussing, right?
Exactly.
Because if you were trying to do this all on your own, it could seem so overwhelming.
Yeah.
And there's endless stones you can unturn. But if you find someone who can help narrow it down to 3 or 4 stones, it's just so much, it's so much easier. I always tell my clients, I'm like, I don't want you to stress about it. I want to take that stress for you.
Yes.
We will figure it out and we will like, we will figure out all the things we need to investigate. I don't want you to have to spend hours on Google every single day investigating, because it's probably going to drive you crazy and wreck your nervous system all at the same time.
Exactly. Yes. So I highly recommend finding a knowledgeable functional medicine practitioner, naturopathic doctor, people like Dr. Natalie. Speaking of that, that segues really well. Yeah. Can you kind of, because we're wrapping up on the hour, can you tell us like what you do, you and your husband, Jake, and how people can find you, work with you, all the things?
Yeah. So my husband and I, Dr. Jake, we practice together. He is like, I always say he's like Dr. House. Like when in doubt, we get cases from all over the country sent to us because he is an investigator. That's what he loves to do. He loves like true crime because he loves the investigation piece. Yes. He works with a lot of our male fertility clients. He is trained in mold. So he knows, he's a very, very mold literate practitioner. But a lot of autoimmune things, gut related mold, you name it. If he can't figure it out, he can almost always point you to someone who can. And then I work with a lot of our women, who are dealing with PCOS and infertility and things like that. And we just really address it from a foundational approach. You can find me online at the PCOS doc, or PCOSdoc.com. And you can reach out and find out if we can help you based on where you're at and all the things. I also have a pregnancy prep group. If you do want to prepare your body to a self-paced course, we run it live a few times a year. You could also do that if one-on-one is not financially feasible for you. So we have all sorts of options, just like Dr. Leah, as far as courses go. So there's always a solution if you need to find more information, but we would love to help any way we can.
I love that. Yes, I've been referring so many people to you guys, and it's just so nice to know that there's such great practitioners out there who can still work one-on-one with people and really get to the root cause and find things, especially for me as I've taken a big break, as people know, during my pregnancies, so that my nervous system is not freaking out. You know, there's seasons. Exactly.
I love that.
So thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom. This has been such a helpful podcast, and I think people are going to love it. Thank you.
Good. You're welcome. Thank you.
Do you have your heart set on starting a family and are eagerly preparing to begin trying within the year? Have you been actively trying to conceive for several months? Do you have a burning desire to optimize your chances of conception and avoid the distressing path of infertility? Or have you been navigating infertility for a while, yet you yearn for new solutions, a supportive environment, and an approach that addresses the root causes of infertility? Our current fertility system is broken. Many couples receive almost zero support on optimizing their health and improving their chances of conceiving before or while trying to have a baby. 1 in 7 couples end up trying for over a year and then are often shuttled into the medication or reproductive technologies routes like IVF. Though there is a time and a place for these tools, so many couples would have different outcomes if they had the education, resources, and support I provide in my Fertility Formula Bundle. This program is a bundle of 13 mini courses about everything a couple needs to know. Each mini course consists of invaluable information, as well as exactly what to do step by step, with all of the resources I have created over many years seeing patients in practice. From mastering the cycle to boosting egg and sperm quality, balancing hormones, investigating female and male fertility, nourishing the body, fostering fertility energy, ditching toxins, reducing stress, rebalancing the gut and vaginal microbiomes, and detoxing prior to pregnancy, this bundle has it all. This is the information you aren't getting from your regular doctor that will only improve your chances of conception and the health of your future baby, no matter where you are along your fertility journey. And it costs less than 1 appointment with me. Visit www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HOPE to save 15% off the entire bundle. Again, that's www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HOPE to save 15%. Okay, back to the show.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.